This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so that means it must be Christmas or New Year's. Wait, those are over, so it's time for us to return to our Wednesday tradition of The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Coming up, we'll consider the resignation of Metro North's embattled president, the death of a well-loved Connecticut political figure, and the Connecticut connections to Dennis Rodman's diplomatic basketball circus. As always, you can join the conversation 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at Where We Live. You can also follow the show along at WNPR.org. We're going to start with a fresh new year in statewide politics here in 2014. We'll bring in our guest, as always, Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Mark Pazniokas is here. He's Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. You look well-rested, Paz. Welcome back.
I am. Happy New Year.
Daniela Altamari joins us. She's State House reporter for the Hartford Current. Hi, Daniela.
Hi.
Well, you were just writing, Daniela, about these Republicans who are going to fight for the right to challenge Governor Malloy. I'm going to challenge you early on and say, can you name the Republicans who are going to vie for Governor Malloy's seat?
Well, it's an ever-growing list, and I think in about an hour it'll grow one more because Mayor Mark Boughton, Danbury, is going to be entering the race. The field is growing. It's time. It's the beginning of the year. You know, the conventions are, 4 months away? So it's about time, people getting in the race.
That was an SD-esque pivot, I think, Colin. Yeah. She didn't answer my question. She moved right away from it.
Like
she
being,
couldn't name
like
them all.
Being asked
she?
To name the seven dwarves, either the real seven dwarves or the seven dwarves from 1988, I think it was.
Paz looks ready to go. Paz, can you name the—
I actually heard you trying to get the congresswoman to give a position on medical marijuana. It was quite amusing yesterday.
Well, you know, it was a little bit of fun. But no, do you know who all's running here? I mean, we're going to hear from Mark Boughton later on today.
Mr. Boughton will be the fourth candidate to jump in as far as folks are actually out there raising money. And those four, let's see if I can do this. John McKinney, Mr. Mayor Loretti of Shelton, Boughton is three. And then you have Joe Visconti, who has not a prayer, but he is a former town councilman in West Hartford. And then there's a couple other folks who have actually created committees, folks that you haven't heard of. And you never will hear of because they're not raising money and there don't seem to be folks that people are taking seriously.
Well, we'll start with this group that is either in or just about to get into the race, Colin, as we hear about Mark Boughton deciding that he is going to officially run here. I mean, what does this field look like to you so far? You've been writing about the Republicans' chances so far and whether or not they have much of a prayer to do much in statewide politics in 2014. What do you think of this group so far?
Well, maybe one way to sort of go at this is just to remind people of sort of the basic ratio in Connecticut politics. And it varies a little bit in terms of voter registration and stuff, but it's basically unaffiliated to Democrat to Republicans, about an 8-7-4 ratio. So if you're the Republicans, you're the four. So the first thing you're not going to be able to do probably is carve a victory out of your own registration. You're going to have to form alliances. You're going to have to court heavily with those unaffiliated voters. So as you look at this field, one of the first questions you have to ask yourself is who could talk to that group of people? And, of course, they are not one group of people. There's not 800,000 people who have a whole set of tenets and creeds to which they all subscribe. But you know, as you look at all these people, you know, who could most powerfully and persuasively speak to those people? I mean, the other questions are just sort of basic name recognition. Who has ever heard of any of these people? People tend not to vote for people they've never heard of. And ultimately also who has a message? Who has a message that's going to be better than Malloy's message? If any of these candidates get any money, one of the things they're going to start doing is focus grouping that question. You know, what actually resonates with voters, particularly the voters we think we need to target?
Given this ratio, Daniela, talk about the candidates in that way. The idea that Republicans, because they're talking right now to a smaller total group of voters, but they also need to be thinking about how this message plays to a wider group come November. How much you handicap some of these candidates going in?
Well, you know, certainly you might argue that John McKinney has done some smart things in terms of reaching out to that group that Colin identified of unaffiliated voters with, you know, the gun laws. Of course, all the candidates, Tony Boucher, I mean, a number of them have staked out similar positions on guns. But, you know, he's also appealed to sort of the for lack of a better term, you know, the suburban voter who's interested in things like GMO food labeling. He was out in front in that issue. And, you know, that might help him with crossover appeal. But then, you know, the other day you had the Democrats hitting hard on an issue like the minimum wage. Clearly that's going to be a top focus for them. And Tom Foley's, you know, basically kind of, you know, another candidate who is not actually officially a candidate but exploring a run has said, you know, he doesn't have anything, he doesn't have any issue with the minimum wage. So, you know, that might have crossover appeal and help him. Who
but
knows?
He does, though, have a lot of issues with Governor Malloy and his record. But it seems, as your colleague John Linder has written again this week, that he continues to make allegations against the Malloy administration, which seem to be not necessarily factually true.
Yeah, and that's been, you know, he's had some stumbles out of the gate so far. He did run in 2010, so he's not exactly a newbie. And you wonder, you know, some of these things that, you know, could be stumbles. I don't know. I mean, do voters care about these things? I'm not sure. But certainly, you know, people who are watching are wondering what's going on.
Yeah, but Paz, last week he says in a press release that state economic aid went to two brothers who are first cousins of a Democratic lobbyist. Linder then reports that these not actually related to the lobbyist.
But they were friends.
And, but they were friends.
They ate in many of the same restaurants.
I mean, I think, to me, Foley's biggest mistake is he's at a point now where he should be reintroducing himself to Connecticut voters, and instead he's lobbing grenades at the governor. And there's nothing wrong with lobbing the occasional grenade. But he seems to be under the misimpression that people know who the hell he is because he came within 6,400 votes 4 years ago. But memories are short in politics among the electorate. And Tom Foley is not front and center. He hasn't been front and center in close to 4 years. So he seems to be stumbling a bit as far as grabbing the opportunity to make an impression on voters to say, hey, this is who I am. This is what I'm about. This is what I will do different than Governor Malloy. And instead, we have a series of things like the story John wrote this week where people, you know, kind of scratch their heads and say, what is he about? Now, I don't think the general electorate is paying that close attention. None of these mistakes are fatal in that sense. But what it is doing, the Republican insiders who will take the first crack at this at the convention, they're starting to ask themselves, is this guy ready for prime time? And that's a problem because there's no real obvious candidate in this field like, oh, my God, he's the guy we all need to be behind.
Colin?
Well, you know, I mean, if you contrast, I mean, I think probably the other person, if there is such a person, and I agree with Paz that there really isn't, but I mean, John McKinney is probably the person, at least in the very, very early going. We really haven't seen Boughton run. We haven't really seen what these people can do. But in the early going, John McKinney, because he has a little bit of visibility, people might kind of know who he was. And you know, he has a disadvantage, which is that he's voted on a lot of things. And that tends to be a disadvantage. You create a record which people can run against. Tom Foley has no such disadvantage. He has never voted on anything. It seems as though he's trying to even that up by making so many mistakes and so many weird stumbles and allegations that he's erasing the one advantage that he putatively might have against McKinney, which is you can't really point to a whole lot of things that he's done wrong that don't involve driving too close to somebody else's bumper. And so it's if he has handlers, they really once again should be probably telling him to pipe down a little bit and wait and see and also see who he has to run against because whoever it is, it's not Malloy at first. I mean, ultimately, you have to run against a whole bunch of other
people. There were 50,000 Republicans who chose the last Republican nominee. You have to keep that in mind. This is a very small universe. He won with 50,000 votes in a three-way primary in 2010. So, I mean, the one smart thing he's doing is he's dodged on the issue of guns because the other the other folks who are considered serious contenders are all on record to one degree or another in favor of that gun law. You know, Mark Boughton is a member of Mayor Bloomberg's Mayors Against Illegal Guns, so that kind of rules him out as far as, you know, gun owners. Tony Boucher and John McKinney voted for the gun control law. And again, in a small primary, small blocks of voters can be decisive. And there are 200,000 folks in Connecticut with gun carry permits. Not all of them are registered Republicans, but I think we can assume that they tilt Republican. Most polling in Connecticut tells us that's the case.
We're talking with Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror, Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, and also a columnist for the Hartford Current, and Daniela Altamari, who's State House reporter for the Current. We'll take your calls in a moment as we talk about statewide politics in this very important election year, 2014. You can call us at 860-275-7266. For all the work, Colin, that it seems as though these candidates aren't doing to try to tell a story about Dan Malloy's record, it seems as though you and Paz and John Lender and Daniela Altamari all are writing stories or talking at great length about the way the Malloy administration has decided through the DECD to fund various activities. Just another story this week about the Back Nine Network. Our Jeff Cohen has been reporting about money going to Earl O'Garrow to move from Windsor to downtown Hartford. Do you think that that is a story, the way the state has decided to spend money on corporations, some of whom maybe were going to add jobs in Connecticut anyway? Do you think that's a way that Republicans actually attack the Malloy administration this year?
Well, I think it's a way that they will attack the Malloy administration. Whether it actually works with voters, I do have to sort of confess a certain agnosticism about this. I mean, one of the reasons that campaign consultants get all the money that they get is they really do go into focus groups and they do polling and they try to figure out what really does resonate. To me, I mean, I think there are substantial questions about this, whether it's an effective means of economic development, whether it's really having the kind of job creation impact that the Malloy administration claims it does, whether in some cases we are basically paying companies that were going to stay here anyway to stay here. I think there are a lot of questions like that. Whether they'll resonate as electoral issues is a really separate question. You know, it often turns out that the voters care about something else, something other than what we in the press think is important. I mean, sometimes they just care about jobs in a much more general way.
Based on the governor's response, I think they sense a vulnerability. And the Democrats, by the way, are the only one who have the resources to do any focus groups right at this point. The governor has been he's totally changed his message on economic development, and he is talking almost exclusively about the economic aid that's been given to the small business folks. So he seems to have picked up a little danger about the idea that there's vulnerability on corporate welfare, the big money that went to Cigna, that went to Bridgewater, that, you know, the hedge fund down in Fairfield County,
ESPN,
NBC, you know. So he's talking about what we're doing for the little guy.
Yeah, the big story on ESPN not too long ago. And this does sort of bring into focus this, Daniela, in taking a look at this field of Republicans, do you think that this is something that will actually have some traction?
Well, it's kind of ironic that the Republicans are railing against corporate welfare and the Democrats are kind of the ones, you know, put on the defensive about it. It's sort of inverse of what we often see on the national level. But, you know, I'm not sure. I think Colin's right. It remains to be seen. I mean, you know, campaigns are funny and issues have a way of taking off that nobody can predict, you know, 10 months before the vote.
When we were talking about that list before, one of the people mentioned is Mark Loretti. He's the mayor of Shelton. Now, here he is speaking to WFSB's Dennis House on Face the State.
Well, look, and I think that if I can bring the model that we put together in Shelton for prosperity to the state of Connecticut, I think that that's going to resonate loud and clear to a lot of people.
Yeah, the Shelton model coming to the Capitol in Hartford. Do we know anything about Mark Loretti? I don't know anything about Mark Loretti.
well, I mean, I think there are some issues with some, you know, investigations that were done in the city in terms of corruption. He was never charged with anything. He was never the direct target of anything, as far as I understand. But, you know, that those are issues that if he were to become the nominee, he would have to answer for. And there's also, you know, he's talking about the Shelton miracle and, you know, Mark Boughton, another Mark, will be talking about Danbury as a prosperous city and maybe being a template for Connecticut. So, you know, some might wonder, do the two mayors cancel each other out? We also have two state senators running. Do they cancel each other out? Who knows?
Were you witness to the Shelton miracle, Colin?
Yeah, I was wondering what that Shelton miracle actually is. And I don't think that's a phrase that's going to resonate heavily with anybody, you know, north of the Naugatuck Valley. And, you know, I mean, it's not that mayors can never win these elections. We have a governor right now as a former mayor. But it's usually pretty hard because – and what happens is the mayor is inevitably surrounded by people – in the mayor's town saying, you're so wonderful, Mr. Mayor. You know, it would be so great if all the other people of Connecticut had the benefit of your wisdom and leadership. But the truth is, the other people in Connecticut had never heard of this person. Really, the number of people in Connecticut who know who Mark Loretti is a very, very small number. Slightly larger number for Boughton. At least he was somebody's running mate. At least he's been making a lot of noise. Danbury's a bigger city. But, I mean, for the most part, the Loretti thing to me seems like a vanity candidacy as opposed to a real one.
It's very late to be starting to raise money, by the way. You know, at this point in the game, 4 years ago, I think Beloy had a couple $100,000 in the bank. We're probably going to see McKinney when the next campaign finance filings are January 10th, and we're going to see McKinney with, you know, somewhere six figures. Tony Boucher, a relatively unknown state senator, she raised some decent money right out of the box. Boughton's been raising money since the summer. So I don't know. It's going to be tough for Loretti at this point. It's funny as that sounds that it's getting late.
But before we turn into our very next segment here and move on to something else, as we talk about politics this year and Republican chances, obviously, they're going to try, I assume, to run somebody in all five congressional districts. That hasn't been terribly successful so far. Elizabeth Esty, who we had on the program just the other day, is running in the very usually closely contested 5th congressional district. And as we know, Daniela, that first time around for an incumbent is very, very important. If they're reelected, it's much harder to get them out. I know that you've been taking a little bit of a look at the way Republicans might be challenging seats like Elizabeth Esty over something that we talked about yesterday, Obamacare.
Yeah, and that's the message from the National Committee. How it plays in the 5th District, who knows? It's also, unclear at this point who will her opponent be. I mean, Mark Greenberg's been running since the day after the last election. But
in the last three elections?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Since 2010. But, there's also, a lot of people are waiting to see what's Dr. Pettit going to do. Is he going to get into the race or not? So that's a big wild card. So who knows? And in the other districts, in the 4th, Himes has some competition. The others, so far, nothing.
We talked to Elizabeth Esty yesterday, Colin, about Obamacare. She took a couple controversial votes where she broke with her party and voted with Republicans. She yesterday, and I think every time she talks, is trying to have that balance. Say, Obamacare is something that's going to help an awful lot of people. I support it, but there's an awful lot of things that I need to change about it. Do you think that that's potentially a weakness for her moving in?
Well, of course it is. And I think she's been given permission by anybody in her party capable of giving her permission to say whatever she needs to say, short of, calling it voodoo. I think that's what you'll see anyway, that you'll see this is a very tender area here, this particular district. It's a tippy-toppy district that can very easily tilt Republican. And it probably is their last shot for a while, too. I mean, just as you said, once the person gets in, it's hard to get them out. If they win two elections, the door really starts to – it takes Abscam 2 to get them out of there after they win two elections. So if the Republicans can't make it happen this time, it probably won't happen for a long time. And I don't think Mark Greenberg is the guy either. I mean, I really do think they need to find a better candidate.
I'm going to take a break now. When we come back, we're going to be talking about a longtime political consultant, someone who is much loved by many in politics in Connecticut, Tom DeMoor. We're going to be remembering him with Lowell Weicker, the former governor and senator. We're in the wheelhouse today talking about the week's news. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. We spend a lot of time here talking about politicians and those behind the scenes, and very skeptical, and you might even say cynical at times turns. But this week, the death of Tom DeMoor reminded many in the state about a time when politics could be about people but not be personal, and a time when party lines meant less than ideas. DeMoor died this week at the age of 72. He was the former Republican Party chair in Connecticut, a close friend and advisor to Governor and Senator Lowell Weicker, who we'll hear from in a minute. But DeMoor also helped to advise another campaign, that of Ned Lamont in 2006, when he challenged incumbent Joe Lieberman. Here's DeMoor speaking on a panel at Yale University just a month after the general election. He's talking about the big issue of that campaign, the war in Iraq.
Every time I hear a discussion of the war and a good Democrat and bad Democrat as to where they are on other issues, it really offends me, because the war gets treated as though it's an issue like local zoning. Folks, it is a war, and that was the driving issue.
Colin McEnroe, you knew Tom. Who was he?
I didn't know him as well as probably some of the other people who will be talking today, and I certainly didn't know him as well as Governor Weicker did. But what I knew about Tom DeMoore was, I think I wrote about this yesterday. First of all, I thought Bill Curry had a great line, and I slightly misquoted him. He said Tom DeMoore had many opponents, and to the best of my knowledge, not a single enemy. And he was remarkable that way. And because of the path that he often chose, he was running a lot of races where he did have a lot of opponents. In other words, because of who Tom was, he was often in a battle with Republicans and Democrats, and everybody liked him. and some of this was just this incredibly winning personality. And as you say, a dedication to ideas more than partisan divisions. And to me, what was so important to me was this overriding sense that there's something a little funny about all this, that, you know, you can't take it completely seriously. And from the moment you met Tom DeMoore, there was this kind of antic glint in his eyes. For some reason, I'm sure I'm the only person who thought this, but he reminded me of Bob Newhart. He looked a little bit like Bob Newhart, and he had that kind of deadpan delivery. And he would say something very funny in a very deadpan way to the press in a context where typically the party chairman or whoever DeMoore was at that moment would be saying something very serious to us. And sometimes it took us a moment to process the fact that, you know, that he was telling us a joke.
There was great joy in dealing with Tom DeMoore. The very first statewide race I covered in 1982, the race for governor and the race for U.S. Senate, and Tom was Lowell Weicker's guy. And Tom was the guy who would allow a young reporter to come on to the governor's RV, and that's what they did in those days. It would wander the state in these things. And he would take you to school. And the stuff that some people will tell you today, way off the record and deep background, Tom would tell you on the record. He was a teacher. He was a political practitioner. And he was just a hell of a lot of fun. And that's what I'm going to miss more than anything. I mean, this was a guy who you just found yourself smiling while you were interviewing because he had such obvious passion, such obvious joy for what he was doing. And in a time when politics is getting uglier and uglier, you know, that is going to be so terribly missed.
Well, let's bring in somebody who did know him better than anyone. Former governor and former senator Lowell Weicker was very close friends with Tom DeMoore. He joins us by phone today. Governor, good to talk to you once again. Thank you so much for joining us here on Where We Live.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
You heard the remembrances of these two reporters who dealt with Tom on that side. Tell us about him as someone who you were conspiring with politically, someone who was your friend. Tell us a story.
I think the best thing that could be said about Tom in a professional sense was that he understood the demographic that was Connecticut and that had to be addressed politically. Now, today, that's just out the window. The Republican Party of Connecticut acts like the National Party, which is basically a party of the religious right in the rural South. Tom loved blacks, and I mean that literally. He loved Hispanics. He loved gays. He loved women. I mean, I go down this whole list of people that are actively being thrown out of the Republican Party. He was enormously successful. Don't forget, he was my campaign manager for all of my Senate campaigns except one, and also my run for the governorship. And those campaigns were successful because Tom knew the people that had to be addressed. Issues, yes, that's important, but everybody likes to feel that whoever it is that they're electing has some relevancy to their life, and that's why Tom was so great. He left as Republican chairman after I was defeated. He was certainly far superior to anybody that has, you know, held that chair for a long time. So I'll tell you, it was just a huge shock to me because in addition to politics and his professional side, he was such a close friend personally.
Governor, it's Colin. I wanted to ask you a little bit about that time in 1990, about the conversations that you and Tom DeMoore were having, because obviously you were making a decision to do something that doesn't happen very often. You were going to run with a new party. Did he talk you into this, or did you talk him into it? What do you remember about the conversations the two of you had at that time?
Well, that's an interesting point you bring up. I had been importuned to go ahead and run for governor, and Tom was part of the group that asked me to go ahead and do it. I said, well, I've got to think about this because I finally have a decent job and one that I love and the one that I get paid for. And quite frankly, to all of a sudden up and leave Washington and run for governor, I'd never contemplated that. So I thought, and I ruminated and back and forth in my own mind and with my wife, and I finally called Tom and I said, Tom, I'm going to do it. Tom said, that's just great. I said, but I'm not going to do it as a Republican. I'm going to do it as an independent. Are you out of your mind? Was the response from Tom. It was a total shock to him. But then when we got into it, he loved it. And as you know, he himself then left the Republican Party and remained an independent. Indeed, over the past several years, I've asked Tom to get back into the fray here in Connecticut to run the Republican Party. He said, no way. And quite frankly, the results show it. We haven't elected a statewide Republican for I don't know how long. So, you know, he was pretty savvy in that campaign to finally cut loose and reach out. And thanks to his advice, I made it. And then when I became governor, he stayed. I had two chiefs of staff, Tom DeMoor and Stan Torrey. And Tom gave good advice, and it was Tom DeMoor. I know a lot of people are probably going to go ahead and bite their teeth, that put together the coalition of Republicans and Democrats that passed the state income tax. And that was no small job. We sort of prevailed by one vote. But it also rescued the state from imminent bankruptcy almost. So, yeah, I mean, I can go incident after incident where he stepped up to the plate. One that I just love to tell because it was so important and it shows the difference between Republicans then and now. I called him one day and said, listen, I got a great idea. Why don't we allow independents in the state of Connecticut to vote in the Republican primaries? And Tom thought about it and said, well, let's try it. And we tried it, and we took this issue all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote, said the Republican Party could do its own rules. The reason why it went to the court was the Democrats realized that if we had access to independents, they would possibly go ahead and lose elections. And they were winning them all. So that idea was shared with Tom, became the rule. And as soon as I was defeated and Tom left the chairmanship, the Republican Party eliminated the rule, went back to where it was. Now, if you take a look at the numbers today in Connecticut, independents have shot way past both parties. And the reason I suspect for that is many Republicans just left the party and became independent. But it was that kind of political savvy that Tom had and just totally lacking in the Republican Party today.
We're talking with Lowell Weicker, the former governor and U.S. senator in Connecticut. It's the Wheelhouse, our Wednesday News Roundtable. We're remembering his longtime friend and colleague, Tom DeMoor, who died this week at the age of 72. Also joining us in studio, Colin McEnroe, Mark Pazniokas, and Daniela Altomare. Stand by for a moment, Senator, because I want to bring in Ned Lamont, who Tom DeMoor worked with in his 2006 campaign against Joe Lieberman. And Ned, good to talk to you once again. We just had Colin ask Lowell Weicker about this time that Tom helped convince him, or he helped convince Tom to run for governor. Tell us about the early days of your conversations with Tom in that 2006 campaign that you came so close to unseating Joe Lieberman.
Hey, John. Hey, Wheelhouse. And Lowell. It was Lowell that introduced me to Tom. And I'll tell you, my conversation was very different back in 2005. I mean, nobody was importuning Ned Lamont to run for anything. And all I heard from Tom DeMoor was, are you nuts? But he said it with a twinkle, and he said it with a nudge. I mean, if Lowell was the lion that roared, you know, Tom was the guy with a chuckle. And he just kept everything in perspective. And here was a new guy coming up, not that active in the political game. And he sort of led me through. I think Paz said he was a great teacher. And that's what he was for me. I had a crash course. I wish I had had a little more time with Tom. I would have learned a lot more faster.
This quote that we had from him earlier, this little piece of tape from that Yale panel that I think Paz was a part of as well after that election, he was talking about the war in Iraq as an important issue and an issue that was so different. Lowell Weicker was just saying a moment ago, Ned, about some of the political savvy that Tom possessed, and it seems as though in this way he understood the power of the war, especially that year, to galvanize people to really come out and vote and to think differently about politics. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Tom would always remind you that the war was a moral issue. The war was an issue about national security. The war was an issue for folks that said, how come we don't have early childhood education? We're spending all that money over there. The war is about folks coming back badly injured. The war is about how you treat soldiers with respect. And I think Tom had 50 years of history and perspective, and he knew people. I think somebody was saying, Lowell just said he loved people. And if you don't love people, you're not going to enjoy the game. And he loved people, and he loved the game. And he was always very good at reminding me, make sure this issue resonates with the people you're talking to and listen to how it impacts them.
So, Colin, as we move forward, I think one of the things I want to try to get out of this is this idea that he seemed to represent something that is missing now in politics, but as both Ned in one way and Lowell Weicker suggested in another way, this style that is so different from what we see today actually worked. It actually worked in the politics of the 1970s and 1980s and maybe even as far along as 2006. Why don't we see more of this today, Colin? How do we get it back?
I wish I knew the answer to that, although I think maybe I'm stretching this a bit. There's an odd parallel between what we're talking about here and what's going on in American education, especially higher education. Also, secondary education, too, which is STEM is becoming really important and the humanities are becoming less and less important. And of course, STEM tells you the numbers and the nuts and bolts. And then the humanities tell you why you should care about that and how you should apply some of the technology that you've learned. And, you know, increasingly in politics, we hear a lot more about big data and about micro-targeting. And, you know, this is how you do it. You very carefully craft these boutique messages, and then you aim them like lasers at these tiny little groups, and you shift these small numbers of voters, as opposed to having some overarching message that, you know, really told people why they should believe in a candidate, why they should believe in a party, why they should believe in their government in this particular approach or style to government. And so in all the ways that I think we're losing sight of the humanities, which are really important at the college level and at the high school level, it's kind of the same thing sort of happening in politics. And yeah, DeMore harks back maybe to a more humanities-oriented approach. I don't know how much he knew about micro-targeting and big data and stuff like that. I think he knew more about the kinds of things that we're all telling stories about today.
Does that strike you as right, Paz?
Yeah, I mean, Tom DeMore, at the end of his life, kind of freed himself from the conventions of politics in some ways. And he migrated to people who had a passion for a big idea or a big issue, in the case of Ned Lamont in the war. And that's what you saw. He went from issue to issue. He was involved with the national popular vote, trying to change how we elect our president. As Governor Weicker noted, Tom reacted very poorly to the suggestion that he go back and try to save the Republican Party. He had gone, I think, far beyond that. And the idea that Governor Weicker and he enacted about opening the Republican primary to independents was an idea ahead of its time on how to broaden the base. It went to the heart of politics. What are parties about? You know, a purity of ideology or the ability to elect people, to get behind people who do have that big idea and expose them to the broadest possible audience.
Lowell Weicker, before I let you go, you seem to suggest that the state is a weaker place for not having a stronger Republican Party. Well, what do you think it takes to get a Republican Party that's more like the one that Tom DeMore led?
To go ahead and address the people of Connecticut and what they believe, not what the national party believes. Look, there's no mystery to it. All you have to do is take a look at the results. They are abysmal. And the Republicans, the problem is it reflects on the state in the sense you cannot have a one-party state. And Connecticut is a one-party state because the Republicans reject the demographics that are Connecticut. Well, an important point about to get back to Ned Lamont and his run. Remember, Ned Lamont beat Joe Lieberman in the Democratic primary. It was only when Lieberman then turned around and joined up with the Republicans and the conservatives that he managed to beat Ned. Ned represented what the state believed, or rather his party in the state. Lieberman believed nothing. He'd hook up with anybody just to go ahead and get a win. So I think that if there's anything to be learned from Tom DeMoor, it's that politics has still not changed in the sense that the majority has to be addressed, no matter, I repeat again, whether they're black, Latino, gay, poor, blue-collar, women. I mean, that's what you've got to address. That's what Tom addressed. The Republican Party still isn't doing. They're putting up a group of personalities, basically all of whom believe in the same thing, which is to appeal to a very narrow band of what is Connecticut.
Former Governor and former Senator Lowell Weicker, thank you so much for joining us, sir, once again. And my condolences on the loss of your close friend. Thank you so much for doing this today.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
I also want to thank Ned Lamont, my colleague at Central Connecticut State University, who ran both for governor and for Senate. Ned Lamont, always good to talk to you. Thanks for being here.
John, thanks.
We're going to continue in the wheelhouse when we come back. We're going to talk about a high-profile resignation at Metro North. And we're also going to be talking about, well, basketball and politics. Dennis Rodman has taken along some Connecticut folks for his basketball tour to North Korea. I'm not sure that they're so thrilled about their decision at this point. We'll talk about that coming back, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, in recent weeks, at least two quasi-public agencies have been in the news. New York's MTA made national headlines for the fatal Hudson Line derailment, and the CRRA here in Connecticut, one of 11 quasi-public agencies in the state, received criticism for excessive six-figure salaries. Coming up tomorrow, we'll take a closer look at quasi-public agencies. What are they exactly, and do they work? You can join that conversation tomorrow here on Where We Live. Today, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We've taken a hiatus over the holidays, so we're getting back in the flow of things with Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What's on the show this afternoon, Colin?
The peculiar world of identical twins. We're going to be talking to geneticists, but also to identical twins, about what it's like to share that kind of almost unimaginable bond.
That's very interesting. So that's 1 o'clock, The Colin McEnroe Show. Mark Pazniokas is here. He's Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Daniela Altamari is State House reporter for the Hartford Current. We're going to quickly turn to Matt Flagenheimer, who's a reporter for the New York Times. He wrote about the resignation of Metro North President Howard Permit this week. Matt, welcome to our show. Thank you so much for being here on Where We Live. Hi, Matt.
I'm sorry, say that again?
No, that's okay. Matt, you're on the air, and welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So Howard Permit stepping down as president of Metro North, he's made this his career. Obviously, he's faced an awful lot of criticism after the year that Metro North had. What did he say about why he's stepping down now?
He actually hasn't said anything about this. Those sort of close to him have said that this was something he'd thought about. Ultimately, even before the derailment in December, this had been just a hellish year for Metro North. You had the collision in your Bridgeport in May, the death of a track foreman a couple of weeks later in West Haven, a couple of long outages in both July and September, really outside of the MTA's control. One of them was a freight train that derailed near Spuytenduyvil. Another was a Con Ed feeder cable that failed the New Haven line in September. So this was just sort of one episode after another, obviously culminating in the fatal derailment in December. And by all accounts, he was just, he had a long career and felt comfortable leaving at this point and really just didn't have the stomach for much more of this.
Not the stomach for now senators and governors calling for changes to Metro North. From those you've talked to, do you get a sense that now there will be new leadership and now there may be big changes coming to Metro North, given the fact that many in state government here and in New York say they haven't been responsive enough?
Mm-hmm. Well, a successor has already been chosen. This is Joseph Giletti. He runs Tri-Rail, which is a system in South Florida. He's actually a former Metro North executive as well, and he's expected to return by the end of the month. Howard Permit is staying on through the end of January to help in the transition. But it's sort of interesting to see where it's going to go. At the moment, there's actually a federal investigation going on into the operations and safety culture, as they put it, of Metro North. I believe that's about a month in. There's a little bit of time to go. And we'll see what comes out of that. There's definitely been an investigative eye cast on Metro North that they're not used to seeing. This is one of the premier regional commuter rail systems in the country and has been known as such for some time. So to see them under the scrutiny is something new.
Danielle Altomare, for the first time recently after this last derailment, we heard some folks at the state capitol finally starting to ask questions about whether or not, you know, Metro North is really the right company for this. Do you expect that this is something that's going to be part of this upcoming legislative session? There are going to be more questions asked about the state's relationship with Metro North, given the problems that they've had, Danielle?
I'm sure it will be. And I think Senator Blumenthal and Senator Schumer down in Washington also show no signs of letting up. This is going to continue to become an issue. And I think, you know, all these incidents, as Matt outlined, you know, taken together, you know, will continue to attract the attention of the political leadership.
Matt Flagenheimer, before I let you go, Jim Cameron, who writes about commuter rail and has been a commuter rail advocate for years here in Connecticut, one of the things that he was concerned about was the amount of money being paid to people, including Mr. Permit at Metro North. Is this something that's seen as an issue, that Metro North is paying executives too much money to not do a good enough job?
I don't know that it's seen as being inconsistent with other systems and certainly with other agencies across the MTA. Certainly those sort of six-figure salaries can attract a lot of attention when you see them in plain sight. I don't know that he was paid a rate that was not commensurate with what other leaders of these sorts of systems in the country are paid. But certainly it's an issue that you might see raised once new leadership comes in a few weeks.
Paz?
I think you're going to see a lot of grumbling about a lot of this stuff, and it's going to eventually fade in the session. The idea of Connecticut untangling itself from a multi-state transit authority, I think, is really not realistic.
The question that I keep having is how many, and maybe Matt knows this, how many other operators are there that would be potential successors? It's not like Richard Branson has, you know, a rail line we can sign up.
Yeah, I think it's a very small number. I mean, you see in the person they've chosen, it's somebody with Metro North experience who's actually run a very large system himself. I would imagine you can sort of count on one hand the number of people who check off those two boxes. So it's probably a smaller pool than we would think of the potential successors for this.
Matt Flagenheimer is a reporter for the New York Times who was writing about the resignation of Metro North President Howard Permit this week. Matt, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate
Thank
it. You. Well, we're going to end with something that I didn't think we'd ever have on the Wheelhouse here. Let's listen to a bit of Dennis Rodman.
I'm going to tell you one thing. People around the world, I'm going to do one thing. Your guy behind the mic right now, we are the guys here doing one thing. We have to go back to America and take the abuse. Do you have to take the abuse? Well, we're going to take.
That's just a little bit of a fairly unhinged performance by former NBA star Dennis Rodman, who has been making these, we'll call them diplomatic overtures to North Korea and befriended the tyrannical leader there for some bizarre reason. So, Colin, we started getting interested in this because when I saw this on CNN, the very first thing that I saw wasn't Dennis Rodman, which is strange because it's hard to look away from Dennis Rodman, but sitting right next to him was a basketball hero of mine, Charles Smith, a former Pitt star. I grew up in Pittsburgh. I'm about the same age as Charles. I watched him in college, and he's there with Dennis Rodman. He also comes from Bridgeport. He's got Connecticut ties. Then we start looking down the list, and we also have Vin Baker from Old Saybrook, from University of Hartford, and Cliff Robbins from UConn. What's going on, Colin?
Well, it's first of all, with this group of players who are over there in North Korea right now, obviously the most important position on the team is the team physician. It's hard to know whether this is a basketball exhibition or some kind of passion play about Medicare eligibility. I mean, one of the people on the floor is Sleepy Floyd. Sleepy Floyd is almost my age. He's not quite that old. He's 53 years old, however. I feel that's one of the advantages of a state-controlled media is that Kim Jong-un can say, these are some of the best basketball players in the world. Well, in fact, most of them were some of the best basketball players in the world about 30 years ago. So I think some of this is also just about money. A lot of these guys, no matter what they say, they went through their NBA earnings a while ago, and now they're spokesmen for mattress companies and stuff like that. And, you know, there's probably a fair amount of money being dangled for them to do this.
You know, one of the things that Charles Smith said afterwards, he told ESPN, some of the statements and things that Dennis has said has tainted our efforts. Dennis is a great guy, but how he articulates what goes on, he gets emotional and says things that he'll apologize for later. You know, it's one thing to maybe make a little bit of fun about this, Paz, But at the end of the day, people are dying in North Korea. People are starving in North Korea. It is a regime that is probably as isolated as any has been in world history in the last several decades. Is it fair to say that these folks who are coming from Connecticut and from around the basketball world are going in with eyes wide shut in this way?
I think it's fair to say that they're very experienced diplomats who are incredibly wary when they deal with North Korea directly or indirectly through China or some other third party. I won't pretend to be a student of North Korean politics, but look, I read the same papers we all read, and this is a regime that does bizarre things, that pulls an 81-year-old U.S. war vet off a plane because he fought in the Korean War a half century ago. You know, my only advice to, you know, to Vin Baker is if Kim starts calling him dear uncle, he should be aware that that's not necessarily a term of endearment in North Korea right now.
Yeah, and we forget about it. Vin Baker's story. Colin, Vin Baker has had a sad story over the course of his post-basketball career. As you suggest, some of these guys really, really have fallen on a little bit of hard times until they're rescued in whatever way by Dennis Rodman.
Yeah, actually, for an instructive thing, if you have a few hours this winter, there's a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel called A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan, in which this scenario is anticipated with quite a bit of prescience. There's a genocidal dictator, and there's some American celebrities who are kind of down on their luck, you know, who need cash, who are persuaded to help him kind of dress up and clean up his image. And one of this mostly involved a kind of a dinged-up movie star who's persuaded to be kind of his date or his, you know, pseudo girlfriend in order to make him look like a more appealing person. And a little, this is a little of what's going on. I mean, the other weirdness of this is that Kim Jong-un, who was educated partly abroad and is apparently a big Chicago Bulls fan, he just likes basketball. You know, I mean, this isn't even so much about tarting up his image, although I'm sure that's part of it. But I mean, he just really likes basketball, and obviously he controls enough resources so he can have these guys come over. And yeah, I think their judgment is pretty clouded, and a lot of them are down in their luck in various ways or just not riding as high as they were when they were 28 years old. And, you know, and there's some money here.
Yeah. Okay, so we have about a minute left, and we've done the ridiculous. But I have one more question left to ask, Paz. We have a new head of the Connecticut State Police and other public safety functions here, the first woman to have such a job in the state. Who do we have?
We have a doctor, as the governor keeps referring to her, Dr. Dora Schriero, who has a long career mainly in corrections, but she was a senior advisor, Janet Napolitano, at Homeland Security. I think it's clear she is not going to be the day-to-day person trying to oversee the Connecticut State Police. She's going to be more of a broader policy person because the department does have broader functions. The union so far reacted well. There was not the grumbling that you sometimes hear about having someone in charge who was not a cop. And of course, there's a long history of folks with a variety of backgrounds. We've had judges running the Department of Public Safety because I refuse to call it by the new name, in part because I have trouble remembering it. You know, we've had judges, we've had former prosecutors. So she brings a different perspective. The surprising thing is why Malloy, who interviewed her for corrections officer, why he didn't put her in there. You know, I don't know whether it's because he wanted to have another first. You know, she wouldn't have been the first woman running DOC, but she will be at public safety.
You can read more about her appointment in the Connecticut Mirror. Mark Pazniokas is Capitol Bureau Chief for the Mirror. Always good to see you, Paz. Thanks very much.
Good to be here.
Thanks to Daniela Altamari, the State House reporter for the Hartford Current. Thank you so much, Daniela.
Thank you.
Thanks to Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thanks, Colin.
Bye-bye.
And we just heard from Christine Stort, CT News Junkie. She just tweeted, "I'm running for governor because the status quo isn't working." That's Mark Boughton in a press release. So I guess he's running for governor. We'll have more on that coming up next week in The Wheelhouse. Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankosky.